This is Infidel One. Offending Coyote Down. Offending Coyote Down.
Roger that.
Welcome to Trappin' Radio. We're proud, organic, free-range, wild fur farmers of North America.
Let me tell you a little story about how I was raised. Every day work, every day pray. God, family, friends, yeah, everybody sins. A winner never quits, and a quitter never wins. Help folks in need, don't fall for greed. A jealous man is weak, so think before you speak. If you love them, let them know. If you hate, let it go. Fast can be fun, but sometimes you need slow. God is all good, the devil is so real. So listen up, y'all, cause this is how I feel.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got none. Except for the good Lord up above. I answer to no one.
Now let's cover our sponsors. They do a lot to help support Trappin' Radio. So I'm asking you guys out there and gals to help support our sponsors as they keep Trappin' Radio on the air. First sponsors, Oki Cable and Trap Supply. Jeb's the owner of this. He's out of Oklahoma. Super guy. You'll not meet anybody nicer. It's somebody you're going to want to deal with. You can reach him at oktrapsupply.com. You can give Jeb a call at 918-429-4648. Not only does he do trap supply guys, he's a fur buyer, so if you're around the Oklahoma or surrounding states, give him a call with your fur. When you need stuff, give him a call and he'll get it out to you as soon as he can. Our second sponsor is F&T Fur Harvesters Trading Post. Everything you need for trapping, hunting with hounds, and predator calling. Guys, if you're into trapping fur, hunting fur, chasing fur with dogs, you're not going to be able to think of hardly anything that you can't get from F&T. You can reach them at fntpost.com. You can also give them a call at 989-727-8727. Whatever you want, F&T's got it. Wildlife Control Supplies, proven solutions for wildlife control, delivering value, expertise, and products to the wildlife individual. If you're in the ADC business, control business, even fur trapping, you need to look at these guys' website. Top-notch company, have everything you would want, even the odd stuff that ADC guys are looking for. You can reach them at wildlifecontrolsupplies.com. You can give them a call at 877-684-7262. International number is 860-844-0101. If you're a wildlife control professional, you need to have Wildlife Control Supplies as one of your favorites on your computer or your phone, because when you come across something that you need specialized equipment, Alan will get it right out to you. Now let's go trapping.
See, I'm a flag flying, Bible toting son of a gun. Yeah, I'm hell on the heart, just a rebel on the run. Scared, don't know it, fear, don't feel it. The truth is the light, sometimes you gotta fight. Good beats bad, right beats wrong. I'm a barroom preacher and this is my song. I'm climbing for the top, representing for the country. I'm the people's champ, right out to dead camp. Shotgun toter, Republican voter. Hank Jr. supporter, let's protect our border. To hell with anyone who don't believe in the USA. Cause this is what I say.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got.
Welcome to Trapping Across America. This is your host, Clint Locklear, from the drowned state of Tennessee. We're getting so much rain here. I told my wife if it keeps going the way it's going, I'm going to have to get into some boat building skills. Either that or take my John boat up on and just like chain the front of it to a telephone pole, because we're starting to look like rice paddies around here. It's crazy how the weather changed. All of a sudden it went from cold and snow and ice. It's like 65, 70 degrees and just raining. And wow, what a difference this has made. I'm sure glad that I'm not trying to figure out where I had beaver traps on the river and I got them out of there, but this is going to be nasty for a while. And, you know, it's that time of year where stuff is changing. It's March, 10th, 12th, 15th, 9th, something like that. And, you know, for a lot of guys, trapping season's over with. There's still going to be some places in the country where there's going to be some cat trapping and predator control and raccoon trapping and beaver and muskrats and stuff like that, especially up north, the guys are going to be doing. But for the most part, prime time's over, you know. And it's that time of year we all kind of sit back and reflect and think, and what should we have done, what could we have done, you know. You know, looking at fur prices, this, that, and the other, how should we adjust it, you know. But, you know, whatever you come up with, you can always learn from it, guys. But don't beat yourself up about it too much. You know, hindsight's 20/20. It's really easy at the end of the season to play, you know, Monday morning quarterback, and, you know, you should have did this and you should have did that. Well, in the middle of it, you don't really know. But at the same time, don't beat yourself up about it. But think about what you come up with. You know, I've talked about doing a journal, you know, and I've talked about guys having free reign to do it on Wolfer Nation. What happens when you do a journal like that is unmanly as that may sound to some guys or whatever. It's just a technical skill that if you get in the habit of doing that with certain things, it allows you to see a bigger picture over a longer area, because there's just, it's human nature. You know, we remember the better things or the absolute worst things, and everything in between seems to get muddled around and lost. Well, a lot of times that middle and muddling around is with some really good data and information if one chooses to look at it. So, you know, if you didn't do it last year, maybe make a plan on doing it this year. Or if you just want to see what it's like, you know, try to, whatever you need to do as far as getting permissions and getting your traps ready and different things like that, if you write all those down, just a cheap 99-cent dollar store notebook, and then as you work on them and different things like that, you can write down what you need to have done so you don't forget it. And you can write down, you know, when you're going through there, stuff will start coming back in your memory. And if you had certain traps you had certain issues with, you know, you can throw those to the side, then come up with something you need to do. Do you need to modify them? Do you need to get rid of them? You know, it could be something as simple as that. Is it something that... you can get new pans on them, whatever. Same with conibears. I don't know what it is about body grip traps, but every year, and I don't want to sell these to somebody else, I throw them away, but when I'm running a lot of body grip traps, there seems to be, for whatever reason, that I can't figure out and I can't seem to modify myself around, that there's a couple of traps every year that when I go back and look at them, or I'm using them, they seem to be sprung off all the time. You know, and I'm looking at the dog and the jaw and the way it's filed or not filed or rusted or not rusted or whatever. And I can tell you my own personal self, I get a trap that continuously does that, it goes in the dumpster. I don't want to give that a problem to somebody else. You know, if I can't fix it, I don't want it in my inventory. And that's some of the stuff that I write down when it comes to my own personal stuff. Now, last week, Chip Davis did the show for us. Wow. Still kind of hard to breathe. But he did a really good job interview talking about the live market and stuff. Getting old sucks. That's all I can say about this. And the guys that are a lot older than me, they still call me a young pup and stuff. 46, you know, that's prime time of life, middle age, and all that good stuff. And I understand that. But it's going through the stage where you don't recover as quick you get tired quicker, you run out of breath quicker. It's a learning phase to go through, and I have to admit, I don't really much care for it. Because back in the summer, I broke two of my ribs unloading for a show. No question about that whatsoever. You know, about 2 weeks of being in not the best of spirits and the best of comfort, it kind of went away and this, that, and the other, and I thought it was fine. Well, I'm out about a week ago, and I'm doing normal stuff. You know, I'm making lure. Cindy's going to do some remodeling on the house, so I'm moving some stuff around. I move a couple of trailers around. I don't know what happened. Somewhere in doing normal day activities, which, you know, there's some weight involved here and there, I re-broke those ribs without falling on them, without being in a car wreck, without anything that I can figure out. It's just they didn't heal right or something, and I put them in a weird position under stress, and I don't know, and they decided that they were more happy being in little separate pieces. So that's the reason Chip did that last week. That's what happened. You know, I wish I could tell you some big sexy story about, you know, 800-pound coyote kicked me as I'm trying to, you know, run him down with a claw hammer or something. But really, I don't even know how it happened. But it just happened. And it was, I knew good and well I could not project my voice or talk for an hour last week. And with the pain medication they had me on, I'd be afraid to talk online, because there's no telling what I would say or where I'd end up going with it. So Chip stood in there, and I appreciate that a lot, Bud, for doing that. And he's going to start doing some shows. So if I'm out of town or I can't make it or whatever, he can kind of fill in. You know, he's making a joke that he'd be my Laura Ingraham, which, if you know, she's kind of like the person that goes around all the talk radio shows when they need a vacation, sits in for him. So if that, you know, if Chip wants to do that, I'd be more than glad for him to do that. I think that'd be pretty cool. And, you know, if you want to try your hand at doing a podcast, or you have something that you think would be very interesting to do that, as long as you can record to an MP3 file, if you just want to give it a shot, guys, we can put it up on Trapping Radio and see if that's something maybe you're interested in or not. It sounds really easy at the beginning, and you may have just two or three topics that you think is very important that you can really bring some insight on. But to do it week after week after week, you know, I've jaw-jacked on this thing now, I guess, 144 hours. And it's actually been more than that, 'cause some of them don't make the cut. So that's 144 hours of talking. So it gets kind of sticky sometimes to be able to do that. But if you wanted to give it a shot, and you can send me the MP3 file, I'll take a listen to it. If so, you know, we can get you up online. And the reason I'm saying that is we're going to talk about something as far as social capital here in a minute. And I can see this confusion in trapping so heavy, and if you wanted to try to do something like write a journal or Trapping Radio, feel free to use the platforms I've got out there to do that, to try to help you with that social capital. But before we get into that, after I spent a couple of weeks talking about snaring, and there was a comment or a question or I don't remember how it got to me, if it was on Facebook or email or whatever it was. I'm pretty sure it wasn't on the phone. And the guy was just saying, I wish you would have talked about deer and duck hunters and stuff like that. And that's a really important subject. You know, if you're going to be snaring, you have to come to terms and have a very clear grasp on what can happen when you set that piece of equipment out there. You know, I still have rules that I will never, ever cross. One of them is you never set snares inside a fence with cattle. Never. I don't care what kind of breakaway you come up with or deer stop or any type of technical, you're asking for trouble. Now, you may get away with that for 2 years, and then all of a sudden you've got a farmer taking you to court because you destroyed, you know, his breeding stock or his big bull or whatever. You never, ever do that. The other thing about snares, if you ever get in the predator control side, the way that I've done it, like when I go to the deer ranches that breed deer, and they have deer out in the fields that are not in the breeding pens, but they use them for genetics out in the field with their does, you never, ever, ever set snares with those type deer. Never. If you do, I would have to really question your mental capacity to be a trapper at that point. And here's the reason why. You can do a lot of things with snares to really cut down on the chances of catching a deer, but there's nothing that's 100%. I don't care what you put on a snare. I don't care what you've read in a book. I don't care what you've seen at a demo. I don't care what you've seen on a forum somewhere. There is nothing that is 100% to make a snare where it's deer proof and it'll still hold a coyote. Nothing. Because a coyote a lot of times has more power than that deer. So by knowing that, if you do get in the predator control side, and you know, when you're, it's a lot different when you do it professionally for a professional organization like a deer farm or one of these big hunting clubs. Those deer are stock, just like anything else, and you're there on a business relationship, and almost like a, just like if you were a electrical person or a plumber or a road grader or a fence builder or anything like that. It's, there's not any of this, it's hobby, I think it's fun, he gave me permission, I'm going to go have a good time. That's not part of that part of the world of trapping right there. And if you catch one of these after six generations of having semen put into different does, and they come up with a certain mass and certain height, certain width and everything, and you snag one of those 180, 190 point deer that's had all that in there, and they've, through their biologists, have sit there and thought, well, you know, this ought to be able to breed so many of these does that we have in the fence that already have some of these genetics in there, and this is what's gonna, we're gonna rely on for the next 5 years on this certain size group of antlers to sell to hunters. You're not gonna get sued over the deer you took. You're also gonna get sued over the income loss to that ranch. So by not using common sense, what you're basically doing is running a gamble on anywhere, depending on where you're at and what you catch, of $15,000, $20,000 at the minimum to several hundred thousand dollars on the back end. And if you end up in court over this, you're going to lose, because you're being treated as a professional. And as a professional, there's no way that you're going to ever back up that you have a 100% way to never catch a deer. And this was such a fluke that it just falls under an act of God or something. It's never going to happen that way, guys. So if you're getting it, so you never set them with deer in those situations, and you never set them with cows. Most guys that listen to this show are fur trappers. A lot of ADC guys, most are fur trappers. They want to go out and they want to snare coyotes and cats and fox and stuff like that. Now, as far as I know, unless you're Native American on a reservation, there's nowhere it's legal to snare deer. Luckily, the way the laws are set up, something that's an accident is an accident as far as that goes. Most states will not let you keep the deer, harvest any part of the deer, this, that, and the other, so it's not an accident that's happening on an ongoing basis. So accidents will happen, and the state game people understand that. But just from an ethical point of view, from a trapper, it's your responsibility to make sure that happens on such a small percentage that it's not a big deal whatsoever. Because if you just run out and you put coyote snares on every single trail and under every single fence crawl under, and you ignore the type of trail, because you can tell which trails a deer going down and which trails are other game trails if once you kind of get a grasp on that. And if you look at a fence and it's barbed wire and you got deer hair under it, you know deer's going under that fence. Yeah, you could catch a coyote there just the same, but you're running the throwing the dice on that in such a way, you're asking and setting yourself up to catch the deer. So it's up to you as the trapper to be the one that's going to make that decision. So what can we do as trappers to get that percentage down? And I'm going to talk about some things that has helped me. And I'm going to talk about some things that I have seen or read or heard. I've tried most of them. A lot of it has to do with common sense of where you put them. But one of the things you see in the old books, which doesn't make sense, and I think a lot of this is just like it is in trapping today. People hear something, they got to have something to put in a book or a magazine or a video. Like, we don't have much experience in it, but since they've seen it somewhere, they think that it's just the way it is, and they repeat, repeat, repeat. A lot of that goes on in trapping. If you take a stick over a deer trail or a game trail with deer coming up and down it all the time, and you're running a 12-14 inch loop, 12 inches off the ground, you know that's about a little over two feet high in a trail. And so the theory, I think, when this got started was, well, a deer's longer leg and it's easier for them to step over the 2.5 feet than it is to duck down and go under. And I have no doubt that that happens sometimes. But my own personal experience by using that system, where you just, you know, have a stick going across a trail, you know, when they call them step overs and all kind of, really what it is, it's a duck under. Because especially smaller does, when they go up to that, they feel more secure by just ducking under, because it's really easy for them to do. You can see deer, if you go out and sit around fences when you have alfalfa and stuff on the field, they can go under a fence that's only 12 inches tall and they hardly break stride. It's the dangerous thing you've ever seen. So when this deer is going down this trail and he's got a stick that's going across the trail, it's a little over two feet tall, a lot of times it's easier for them just to duck under. And the dangerous part of snares for me when it comes to deer is what I've noticed, and I don't know how to get away from this. The trouble you're going to have with deer normally comes within 48 hours of you setting the snare. And I think what it is, you got a nosy old doe that smells you up against a bush or whatever, and she's trying to figure out what you're doing, and she's acting like a hound dog at that point. And she's sniffing around for you, and her head's already close to the ground, which puts her in a lot better position to get in the snare. But once you get past that 48 hours, and it's got to be scent, the closest thing I can tell, is that seems to really slow down. But the dangerous area, wind of that, is that 48 hours. And it's always a doe when that happens. Now, for deer hunters and stuff like that, you know, that are worried about you catching their big bucks, if you're running deer trails the way most guys are going to run them, you hardly ever, I have never once, and I can say this honestly, never once caught a buck deer. Because that's just not the way that their pattern of movement is. You've got the does that go up front, the older does are in the back, and then you've got the bucks that come along way better. So if something's going to happen, you know, the girls are going to, you're going to get the blunt of it before the buck gets there. And I think that's just a natural tendency of their order of things to protect the buck, because there's always way more does than there are bucks. So he sets off. So the duck under, or the step over, or whatever you want to call it, or whatever snazzy name someone put it just to stick over the trail. Guys, I'm telling you, if you go about and you try to do that, you're not doing yourself any good. Now, you can use a stick, and you can use vegetation to really curtail deer problems. Now, you almost have to have either a very long stick or up against some form of structure for this to work very well. Just in an open grass field, it's kind of hard. You'd be out there building something if it was just an open field, say, in Kansas. But here in the east, we have a lot of timber, and I'm worried about that, or I'm thinking I may have an issue with that. I can set my snare offset a little bit in that trail up against the structure, which is normally a tree, or really thick brush, or if I'm in laurel or something like that, it's evergreen or cedars or something like that. And then I can kind of maybe trim some of that out a little bit and get it just a little bit more off center. And what I'm doing with this stick is I'm going to put it on a very steep angle just where it's barely not touching the outside of that loop towards the inside of the trail. So if you draw on a piece of paper and you put down two lines and that's your trail, put a tree on one side of it, let's say on the left-hand side, run your snare up close to that tree, and then you're going to lean that stick up just where it's coming over into the side of the snare on the left-hand side. And you'll see you've got an opening on the right-hand side. That's okay. We're going to fix that here in a minute. But you're just going to have the angle of this stick on a... going just big enough to cover that snare. And if you look around at sticks, it's better if you can get them where they're not exactly perfectly straight, so there's some angle on one end, so it kind of curves around a little bit at the top, because you don't want to give a 4 foot walkthrough space that's clear to a deer. So you got to use some judgment. It could be branches off of it or whatever like that, but you want to just give them enough room for a coyote to feel comfortable. You're not trying to close them up so much like you would a cat. Now, when you have that off center of the trail, now the deer's coming down the trail, and he's got a left and a right part of the trail he can go down. This one over here is more closed off, and this one over here is thicker. Now, it's going to be kind of hard to explain. You can do this very crudely by just transplanting some grass or small brush where it's about 12 inches tall, and you kind of fill in that part of the trail that's not where your snare's at. Well, a deer can walk through that a lot easier and will than a coyote will, because a coyote's come down that trail, he's looking, he sees this wall of brush that's not, I mean, he could get through if he wanted to, don't get me wrong, but it's just easier for him at his height to just duck a little bit to the left and go next to between the stick and the tree, and there's a snare waiting on him. And this brush that's on the right-hand side of the trail, if you draw it down on a piece of paper, it just needs to be 12, 18 inches tall. And a deer being higher, because you're not going to fill it in like you're trying to make a grass lawn or something, it'll just step over them and go about its business. And that'll really, really help you on your deer if you go about that way. Now, another thing you can do, if you take a piece of paper, draw two lines at your trail, because the shortness of a coyote and the tallness of a deer, they have two different perspectives when it comes with how they see their terrain and they're going to work through it. So if you've got your stick on an angle, just like we did before, you can actually, off that stick going in both directions, you can make it look very easy for a deer to get around, but start lining your coyote up to go through your snare where it works even better. So on your piece of paper, draw two lines for me, and then off on the left-hand side, you're just gonna draw a circle, and that's the tree trunk. And then you're gonna go down, and you're gonna have the space there where your snare and stick's gonna be the way we set. But we're gonna look at this from the top, not looking down the trail, but if we were a bird in the tree looking down on it, this is how we'd see it. Now, where that stick comes down and touches that trail, draw back on a 45 degree angle or a little bit gentler angle back down the trail one way and back up the trail. So what you're making is a V. So you can put in your little grass and brush or treetops or whatever that are just, you know, 18 inches tall at the most, but you can stagger those. So if you had 3D on your paper and you turn the paper up and you had 3D, what you would see from a coyote's point of view is the trail gently goes over to where your snare's at, because he's on, you know, he's only standing 2 feet tall. So you're getting him into a chute that's guiding him over to where you want him to go. Now, a deer being taller, he's going to see exactly what that is. He's just going to step over it, and he's got a lot of empty space in between the V, so he can step over it and then to step over the other side of the V and go about his business. And to me, that's even better than just putting crap on directly beside the snare, because when you just put something right next to your stick and it's going straight out across the trail, even though it may seem quicker, and it is, what you're doing is when a coyote's coming up that trail, or any animal for that matter, all of a sudden now he has a wall with an opening. And if it doesn't look natural, now you're going to start having the coyote instincts come in play, and he may just totally get off the trail and go around it. But if you have these V's come out on an angle, so from his point of view, if something's on the far right-hand side of the trail, and you go up another foot, and you move that in a foot, and you plant something or put something, you go up another foot and go over to the left another foot, from his angle, it looks like a wall, but it doesn't give him the feeling that he's going into a wall, if that makes sense to you. So when that coyote's coming up, he just kind of veers over because you're kind of guiding him over there. And in his perspective, because he's shorter, that's just the easiest thing to do. But a deer being taller, he can easily see over it, step over it, and go about the business. And then there's no reason for that deer to ever be in a position to have to duck under your duck under stick. Is it 100%? No. You know, one thing that I learned a long time ago about using kill poles is my deer catch was very minimal. I think the deer, at their perspective and height, would see the pole way before a coyote could, because the coyote's got to be looking up to see the top of a coyote-sized kill pole. And just having that alone right there on the trail, it seemed to really get the deer's attention and go about it where it would avoid it, I guess. Now, when I started using more snare supports, that went away, because now the pole's not sitting up there. And there's nothing there really for the deer to get a grasp of or anything like that. Now, another thing that you can definitely do for deer, if you use some form of the stick on the side of a structure, now see, how can I explain this one? Okay, draw on a sheet of paper, and we're going to look at it again from the bird's eye view. You're going to draw your trail. You're going to have your little circle for the tree trunk. You're going to have your little, however you're going to show where the snare's at next to that, and have your stick where it goes down in the ground. Okay, now we're going to do an opposite V on this one. We're going to take the cheapest baling wire that you can find, which is not something out of a trapping catalog, but just from Home Depot or something, because you're not trying to hold anything with this. We're on the left-hand side where you got your tree trunk, you're going to make a V again, and you're going to use two strands of wire, but you're going to go up to where the, how in the world can I even explain this? Where your other V with a brush was going out from the stick and funneling the coyote over, you're not really going to do that. You're going to have a strand or two of wire that's going to be on the left-hand side that goes up, and probably just because of the way things are in the real world, it's not going to be on the stick that's kind of blocking the deer out of it. You're going to have to go across the trail a little bit. But it's best if you can use a fence, so when a deer's coming down the trail, but if you have it above the back of a coyote, the deer will come in contact with that trail or with that fence, and it'll guide him either off the trail or away from your snare, if you can follow what that means. Now at a set, yeah, I've talked about using it where I just kind of string it around, especially if there's a lot of deer, where I string it around a triangle of trees, and that'll work for a set because the deer's already going to be a little anxious and a little nervous because there's something strange there. So when they touch that wire, now they bolt. But they're not going to do that in this situation because you're not using lure or bait or anything that looks strange or anything like that. So you can use just a simple fence to guide them off of the trail a little bit to go around. Now, it's not a big deal if they start making a new trail, because hopefully by the time that that starts becoming prominent, you've already caught your coyote and you're on down to a new stretch of land anyway. So, you know, a couple of weeks is not going to make that big a difference. If you try to do that on a line that you're going to run year after year, you're going to have to adjust that thing every single year, because they will, when they go up against that wire, it'll just slightly guide them off around that snare. Now, I've never done this for deer, but I played around with it in Alaska for moose, and this is, if someone could come up with a commercial version of this that was fairly cheap and very reliable, this would be slicker than snot. If you're snaring up for wolves in Alaska, you don't want to catch a moose, just like you don't want to catch a deer or a cow here. And what they did, because they were using a lot bigger, they're using 1/8-inch cable on this. So you had something that was very rigid. They were using most of the Thompsons, which were similar to a 1x19, more of a stainless steel. It was very rigid snare. And they would take wire and they would wire they would wire this thing to right behind the lock, or either on the lock itself. And if you've got the trail that's going, like on a piece of paper, if you draw it where it's going north to south on a piece of paper and your snare is going east to west, they would take a small piece of wire and run that out parallel and make kind of like a little T on the front of it, so it'd be about 6-8 inches wide. And that would hook to the snare. And if I remember right, it was actually to the lock, because it's been years since I played around with this. And they did that on each side. So if a moose or a deer were to come up, their chest and their right between their legs would hit this little bitty T, and that jolt would close the snare, if you follow what I'm saying. So they had like a bumper out about 12 inches from this thing. So when you had a big old moose coming down a trail, it ain't moving off the trail for nothing. It'll take trees out of the way. So it's coming down the trail, and it hits that little T-bumper that's just, you know, really crude, made out of wire. It would push on that lock and close the snare. And the moose would just, you know, roll it over. And then the trapper would come back and just reset it. And it's much better to reset a snare than it is to deal with a moose or deer or anything else like that. That was a very slick concept. I don't think it ever really took off anywhere except there. But and you're not going to be able to use it probably with very thin wire, because it's going to be too much weight. But it was a pretty slick type thing. And you may, you know, just thinking about it off the top of my head all of a sudden, if you came up to your support wire and if you could figure out an angle, like with a bow, for instance, and you could wrap that thing like a, see, if you look at a snare swivel, you see how that metal is wrapped, and then you've got the swivel part on the end that you hook your pigtail to. It's just like a spring that's really tightly wound, and it can move on the cable very easily. Well, I mean, you can buy those little spinners at any convention you want to play around with this. But if you left two open ends on that thing where they come out maybe 18 inches per se, and you ran it maybe a 1/2 inch where it was just sitting loose on that, you'd have to figure out some way to keep it upright, which I guarantee you, with the creative way trappers are, like maybe just having a underneath loop or something. You have to get creative, because I haven't done this. But you could run it off of that little support collar like there is on a snare wire, run that off on an angle and just have a one leg bumper sitting out there, maybe 12 inches or whatever. So when the deer hit the bumper, it would go at an angle and it would just push the lock closed, if you follow what I'm saying. It'd be a really crude thing. The hard part to figure out from doing this is how it doesn't swivel where it's just up and down, straight up and down in the air. But if you got that part down, dude, that would be slicker than snot right there. That's when I say, guys, someone say everything in trapping's been made. No, it hadn't. It really hadn't. I mean, would you sell $1 million worth of these things? Probably not. Did you have a decent little side business selling something like that? Absolutely. You know, in 3 or 4 years, once people started copying you, which they're going to do because we're in the trapping industry, you'll lose a big part of that sale, but by then, hopefully, you went on to something else. But something as simple as that, which the wire's cheap, if you had a jig set up where you could make, you know, several hundred of them while you watch TV at night or whatever, you can make some decent little money with coming up with, like, the engineering part of it. And I know good and well Dustin out in South Dakota, as soon as he reads that, his brain's already going 900 miles an hour. Knock yourself out, Dustin. And if you figure that out, that could be a way that anybody, after it's tested, and if it treats a deer just like a moose, you could set those things in more in really open deer trails, and it wouldn't make any difference. If the deer come through tonight, you just reset your snares. If they don't come through tomorrow night and the coyote comes through, you catch your coyote. And it takes a lot of the issues out of the way. And guys, that was just strictly off the top of my head. If you want to go through the learning process to figure out how that works, I think that'd be really cool. I know I'd buy them if they worked. I would use them if they worked. And it would be something, especially for the market of guys that are in states that can snare them, and they're intimidated by the trapping. You have a whole market sitting there ready from the hunter side of things, besides this, the trappers. So it'd be a good deal if you figured it out and showed that it worked. Anyway, part of the reason that this snaring thing is interesting to me, and before I get started on this, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. Georgia right now, there's a bunch of guys in Georgia that want snaring and a bunch of the guys that don't want snaring, and a lot of the guys that's kind of started the organization, they seem to be, just from what I'm hearing, the guys that don't want snaring, and a lot of the other guys are getting frustrated. And I don't know the whole story, and I'm not on the side. I'm not in that state. Y'all do whatever it is that y'all need to do. But when you're making these decisions, guys, about this, anything that's new to an area or to a group or to the game commission in Georgia, or guys that are worried about problems, it's just human nature to automatically be scared of something new. We're not a lot of different when it comes to coyotes when it's like that. Anything that's new or out of the ordinary is scary because you automatically go to the far end of the spectrum of what could go wrong. And then you, in your mind at that point on, that's your normal. Now see, we touch Georgia. And we have very liberal snaring laws up here. And I cannot think of anything in the last... Well, I can't think of anything that there's been an issue publicly with snares. None whatsoever. You know, we can run 564s, 3/32nds. We can do anything with snaring short of putting it on some type of like a ram snare where it's a mechanically closing thing, or doing the old mountain man, you know, hillbilly thing of bending over a great big sapling and hooking the snare to it so when it's fired it jerks it off the ground. You know, that's what our state law is talking about. So besides that, we can use any lock we want. We can use, we're not regulated to deer stops or this or that. And we don't have issues with that. Now, we've had issues with body grips. And most of the time, it's a fluke thing, and it's the few times it's been an issue, either someone was doing something illegal, and or probably wasn't even a real trapper, just somebody trying to catch something. I mean, I was in Texas, I think it was 3 years ago, and my phone blew up one day. Now, I only get, when I go down there, service maybe when I go to get fuel. So I didn't know my phone was blowing up. I get back to get fuel, and there's text on top of text on top of text on top of text. And, you know, guys were cussing me and all mad and this, that, and the other. And it took me forever to figure out. So finally, in one of those texts, what had happened when I was 1,200 miles away from home and been down there for 30 days already, somebody in Dunlap, Tennessee, which I would almost bet it's not somebody that's in a trapping organization, knows anything about trapping or whatever, because this was so crude. But they were trying to catch something, which was probably a bobcat or a coyote, I don't know. And they put 330s, which is illegal for us to do on dry land here in Tennessee. And they were baiting the triggers with bacon. And you can imagine the house dog issues they were having, because they were setting it up in the side of a cubby or on a tree or something like that. Anyway, it was probably blowing back, and they would catch these dogs and they would just kind of pitch them off to the side and reset the trap. Somebody found it, you know, breaking laws, Dunlap, Tennessee. Everybody just assumed I was doing something and I was 1,200 miles away. Now, that was an issue we had, which probably wasn't even a real trapper. He probably got the dang things down at the co-op, figured out how to set them, and wanted to catch something. We've also had, in Georgia, one of our congressmen or something, our senators or something, they were down on a friend's farm in Georgia, and a dog went over a beaver dam, and a body grip was half in, half out of water on the crossover, caught the lab. I don't remember if the lab died or whatever. Georgia basically said, we got a big beaver problem. You know, it was set legal. Sorry it happened, whatever. This guy came back to Tennessee, and I thought we were going to lose body grips in Tennessee over something that happened in another state. So it's hardly ever anything to do with a snare. I can't think of one publicity problem we've had with snares. You know, and if I, just my own personal preference, because what y'all guys do in Georgia is up to Georgia. Y'all need to figure out what's best for you. But I will tell you, in a southern state with as many free-ranging dogs as we have, I feel more comfortable setting snares than I do foothold traps. Because I'm not setting them under fences on short snares, and anything's going to get hung up. But on trail snares, if I've got a pack of wild dogs or hunting dogs that went down a trail where I'm bobcat snaring or coyote snaring, all I've got to do the next morning is go down through there, put my catch pole on them, cut the cable, spank them on the butt, and send them on their way. That's it. There's no damage. There's nothing there for a landowner to see. I've never, not once, killed a dog in a trail snare. Never. They don't act like a coyote. Now, there's been some feral dogs that's been close because they acted just like a feral dog, like a coyote. But in a southern state where you have that many animals, even though it's hard to convince a non-trapper that doesn't have experience of that, it's much gentler on domestic animals to use snares than it is any other thing else. I mean, I've had dogs that I've caught 12, 13 times in 15 days. Towards the end of it, they were wanting to go home with me because it wasn't hardly any stress to the situation, especially hunting dogs. They just sit there. So that's one thing to keep up. But if you're in Georgia and you're worried about the snares, and you automatically go to the absolute worst scenario that could possibly ever happen, guys, just think about Tennessee. We border you. We have the same type of country as you do. We have the same dog problems you do. We have everything. All a snare is a tool, and it's actually a gentler tool for the South than footholds are. So whatever y'all decide to do, I give you two thumbs up, whether it's for or not. But if you're going against it because of fear, of something that may not ever happen, that doesn't make a lot of sense. It's the same thought process. If I walk up to somebody, and if you're in this situation, you're going to know exactly what I'm telling you the truth. If I walk up to you being an entrepreneur, and I said, guys, I think you could make more money doing X, Y, and Z. You'll have more free time. You'll have a better form of life because you'll have more freedom. You'll be able to see your families more. It's something you can grow. When it's all said and done, you can sell that to somebody else and have a really nice retirement from it. Someone with a nice job that's comfortable, that's been in this kind of rut forever, and they've fallen for one of the three biggest addictions Americans have. One is drugs, one is carbs, and the third worst addiction Americans have is salaries, in my opinion. But if you question the salary to someone that has a nice salary and's in this kind of rut, even though if they're miserable at their job and their family life is miserable because they're so miserable, and they got 10 more years of being miserable, that salary addiction locks them in there. And this is what happens if that's brought up to them. They automatically go from the nice salary that shows up every week to living under a bridge, homeless in a box. Bankrupt, they lost their house, their cars, their insurance, they're destitute, and they're eating out of garbage cans. That's human nature to go that route. But in reality, if someone with a salary started their own business, that's so far from the percentages that happen that it's like winning the lottery. And at the same time, even if the way that you look at jobs today, the way the job market is with automation and with technology coming into different businesses and stuff like that, that same person that automatically be scared to death to do that right now could be cut tomorrow, and now he's on a lifestyle system which he has nothing to back himself up for, that has a better chance of living under the bridge than he did if he did something for himself. So human beings are always afraid of something that's a little strange and they don't have a guide map for, because going to work is easy. Running your own business, not so much. So they jump to that conclusion. The reason I'm using that example, because most people will understand that. If you've got a nice job, the idea of starting your own business scares you to death. And you automatically go, and if you're the type of person that's more risky, your wife will automatically be living under that bridge, eating out of the garbage cans, trying to figure out how the kids are going to get to school within 30 seconds of you bringing up that conversation. And just listen to her, and she'll walk you all the way through how you're going to end up under a bridge. The reality of that is insane. And a lot of times when it comes to the trapping tools with trapping organizations, what I see when I talk to people is they automatically go from, we're comfortable, no one's messing with us, this, that, and the other, and if we do this, somebody's going to do something, and something's going to be seen, and we're living under a bridge eating out of garbage cans. If that's the reason Georgia's going against the snares, y'all need to have a more of a conversation about the whole thing. If there's other reasons you don't want snares that I may not know about, then y'all might be doing the right thing. I don't know. Like I said, I'm not on one side or the other of this. But it's just something I've noticed, because Ohio went through a thing where they were trying to get 220s on dry land, and I was at several Ohio shows over a couple of years, and you had the guys that wanted a better tool. And then the other stretch was, we're living under a bridge eating out of garbage cans. And there wasn't any middle ground there at all for logical and reasonable conversation. So just, you know, when you're at these meetings or you're talking about stuff like that, if you find yourself living under the bridge eating out of a garbage can in 30 seconds, you're not being very reasonable with that thought process. Because very few people, even if they start a business and it doesn't work, are they living under a bridge eating out of a garbage can. You know, it's just not the real world we live in. Now, one thing I want to talk about really quick is I know there's going to be a lot of guys that's going to be out muskrat trapping and beaver trapping during spring season, especially up north. And I want to give you a little tip here, guys. If you're in an area that's getting a lot of pressure, and it's historically a lot of people go out and trap at a certain time of year, or you just have a lot of trappers in your area and stuff like that, that's when you got to start thinking a little bit above the average. And I don't know what it is about a body grip trigger, but animals seem to know that that's not a natural thing, even if it's half in, half out of the water and you just got two little things sticking up. Or if it's in a trail, whether it be for mink or coon, or you're in the water for trapping, here's a little tip you ought to try, just for your own craps and giggles a little bit. If you go out and you start scouting, or you start going out or whatever, you're going to come across a lot of plants, especially in the northeast, in a temperate climate like we have. You have a lot of herbaceous plants, and a lot of those plants are actually hollow. So it wouldn't take you very long, I promise you, just to go to any field and with a pair of a knife or snippers, start cutting some of these different vegetation pieces, and you'll find out that they're hollow. And depending on the size of the body grip you're using, from a 110 to a 330, you're going to need a different size, whatever. But if just for your own sake, let's run a little test if you're doing that this spring or next fall. If you're going to run, say, 50 body grips or 100 body grips, let's say 100 just to make the math easier, run 50 of them like you've always have, and run 50 of them with something that's natural over the trigger. So what this means to you as a trapper is, while you have these plants out there, you just need to go cut a bunch of them. And if you're, you know, you can kind of judge in a lot of these plants. And after a while, you can start picking them up where you're trapping at, because you'll start recognizing what they are. But, you know, if something's 3 foot tall, that's a lot of trigger pieces. And if you get a decent pair of snippers, you know, this little bitty pruners that have good blades on them, you in an afternoon and your kids could go out and get 5 gallon buckets of these things and go and cut them to somewhat close to length, and just put them in a bucket, put them somewhere where they're not going to get rain and they don't rot and they kind of dry out. You could even put them in bundles and hang them from a barn roof so they dry. And then when you go out and you use them, just have a little bundle of them in your bag. When you're going to put your trap in, slide those things over, and a lot of the plants you'll find almost have like a little cork substance in them. I'm not sure what it is, but when you push that down on top of a trigger, it'll kind of push the top end. You can break it open, but it gets it really tight. And if you, especially like for raccoons or mink, if you set these things in a trail and you're very careful, and if you're new to trapping or you're not new to trapping, do what I say, not what I do on this one. Use the little safety setters and put them on the body grip and get in the habit of just kicking some duff over the bottom of those jaws, so it looks like the trail continues instead of having the two jaws sitting on top of the ground. Now, you're going to have to adjust that though when winter really sets in because of freezing. But get in the habit of kicking that over that, and it really hides the outline of that trap. Now, instead of having the metal trigger sitting down in there, and the thing about it is when you put that duff over it, if you let it fall up against the base of your trigger, it hides that big square block and natural looking thing to the animal. Slide those things on your trigger, disconnect your safety, and step back, and you'll see it looks really, really more natural when an animal's coming down. And if you'll run 100 of these, or 50 of these, or 20 of these, whatever your number's going to be, run half of them with them like that, with the natural piece of wood. You know, bamboo's a little hard because it's got the hard pieces in the middle, but there's all kind of plants that you can do this with. Reeds, anything. It doesn't make any difference where it's just natural. You don't want it too big, you know, where it blocks up your trap, but you just want to have it where it's a little bit bigger and it's hollow and you can slide it down on there. Run those tests. Put a little bitty magic marker on some of the jaws on the spring so you can see it real easy. And keep a note, which one catches more animals? And what you'll find out is the one with the little piece of natural material that's over the metal trigger of a body grip, even if it's in the water sticking up, you'll find out that you'll start catching more animals with those particular traps. And the reason is, they're used to rubbing up against something natural all the time. But if you put something unnatural in front of them, they're going to do exactly what you do if there was if you're going through the woods and there's an old fence post sticking in the middle of the trail. You're just going to kind of like move your body around it and go about it. You know, you're not going to put much thought into it, but you're going to try to miss it. You're not going to run into it. You're definitely not going to smash into it or your face. But if it's just weeds and you're out pheasant hunting, you're not going to try to dodge every single weed you come up against. And it's the same thing, I believe, with the animals. That's just a little tip to try. Even on your beaver, even if the muskrats are, now if it's totally submerged, I don't think it's going to really make that big a difference. But if you're going to have any of that trigger exposed, try putting some natural material on there and just watch what happens. It's one of those little tips that could get you an extra 20%. Well, that may not sound like a lot, and it may be a little more or just a little less. I've never ran numbers on it like that. But if you're catching 100 animals, that's 120. And that 20 is normally where the profit really starts getting good because the costs aren't coming out of it as much. And that's when you can start making more money from your trapping. Little bitty things like that really add up. And that's not a gadget or a gizmo type thing. That's just presenting your set in a more natural way. And I'm going to make a comment here that's just to one person that's a good friend of mine in Mississippi that did the radio show last week that I'm not going to mention his name. With the new thing that you're doing with the bobcats down there, I would definitely look into doing this for your cats. That's all I'm going to say about that one. But if you're going out, guys, and think about, and not just with this, because see, I'm telling you something on there. That's a technique on how to do something. But what you have to do is take that technique and then use that thought process on maybe some different things that you're doing. Whatever that may be. Instead of just wanting me to tell you something, all I'm doing is trying to give you a compass. That's all this show is. It's a compass. The best way that I know how to do what I know how to do, and I'm trying to give guys a compass, girls too, a compass that they can how to head into a certain direction. And as long as if efficiency is what you're always after, that should be your compass setting. If it's just having fun with the kids, that should be your compass setting. If it's making money, that should be your compass setting. If it's just going out and having a good time and you know, being one with nature, that should be your compass setting. And this is a technique that can be used inside of that compass setting. And the more that you hear a technique like that, it's not a standalone thing in a system by any stretch of the imagination. It's just a technique of a bigger system. And then you start looking around, and that may put something in your mind that maybe I've never thought about, but if you're heading in that same direction, you start seeing different possibilities and opportunities all around you. And it just makes trapping so much cooler, in my opinion. Now, before we close, I told you I was going to talk about social capital. Now, social capital is not just in trapping. It has to do with being a good husband or a wife or a mom or a dad or a employee or a business owner, and most definitely a trapper in today's world. you see this all the time, and apparently it's causing a lot of frustrations with trappers. And all you have to do is look on Facebook. Facebook and the internet is a very unique thing. It's actually still really new. I don't even think that it's got enough birthdays in it to legally have sex yet. I mean, it's still really new. But what it's done is it's taken away gatekeepers, and it's taken away a lot of the different things where you had to be picked, and it allows the individual a platform to say, this is what I'm doing, look at me, and then however that's taken after that point depends on what that person wants to do. What's getting confused, I believe, with the internet, especially on Facebook, the reason you see so many forms of dichotomy on Facebook is Facebook is just an example, but it's a platform, guys, that gives you a chance to stand on your own, it be in the public's view, and have an opinion one way or the other, or different ways or whatever. And it's a way that someone can, that you can reply to, and you can be replied to with whatever it is you're saying. Nowhere in history has anything ever happened like this. Now, what happens is you put something out there, and then it can be negative or it can be positive. And y'all, like I said, just go to Facebook and look up and down and watch what happens on any night of the week when it comes to Facebook. And you have guys that are trying to get into the lure business, or they're trying to get in the supply business, or they're trying to get in the snare business, or ADC business, or control business, or they want to be recognized as the best trapper in the country, or they want to be recognized as the best predator trapper, coyote trapper. I mean, all you have to do is look at someone's post, and it becomes very clear what it is that they think is important and what they're putting out there to the public. And that using the internet or Facebook as a platform, you can stand on that little pinnacle and go, I'm saying something, I think it's important. Or you can stand on that pinnacle and you can look around and you can see what someone else says, and you can go in and either agree, disagree, or attack. And a lot of the attack and a lot of the absolute negativity that's coming from Facebook and platforms like that, you see it in forums too, is even though the internet gives you a platform to speak your opinion, what it's made is opinions are not worth hardly anything today by themselves. It's made them a very cheap and overwhelmingly saturated commodity. So what used to be, when someone were to say something like that, it had more pull. Now it doesn't have any more pull, because there's tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of trappers standing on their pinnacle saying, look at me, either what I'm saying or what I'm saying to you. But there's no social capital built that way. And social capital, guys, is if you want to have somebody ever pay attention to you, you're going to have to build social capital. And that's going to be different for every single person. It could be helping other trappers out. It could be having a good lure line. It could be having the fastest service in the supply business. It could be being the guy that has the techniques that help guys be better trappers, or it could be some form of a way to help get kids involved. But it's got to be something, and it has to be something that's seen by other people as having value. And a really good example of this is, y'all heard me talk about O'Gorman, and the older guys that listen to this show will know exactly what I'm saying, especially if you're hooked into social media now. 10 years ago, 15, 30 years ago, Craig O'Gorman had massive social capital. even if you didn't like him, if you hated him or you were a fan of his, when Craig O'Gorman said something, everybody listened. They may go instant into attack mode, or they may whatever, but his social capital was such a high point. The same thing with Johnny Thorpe when it comes to trapping. A lot of guys like that. It was a time before social media, but their social capital was so high. If they wrote something in a magazine or sent out a letter or put something in their catalog, it was like E.F. Hutton. Everybody listened. And they put weight to what was being said by that person, even if they didn't like them. Because Craig had built so much social capital back in the early 80s and late 80s and early 90s that when he said something, even if you disagreed with him, it would make you step back and question why he says that, because obviously he believes that, because that's the way his social capital was built. And maybe it's something I need to look more at in my own views of that. That's what social capital means. It means what opinion that's got something on the backside of it that's already built this base, that when your opinion is said, it means something. Now, I know your mother told you were special. My mama told me I was special. My neighbor's mom told them that they were special. But the thing is, if every mom tells every kid that they're special, how special are they? And we're seeing that everybody's special mentality on internet and on Facebook. So someone gets up and they state an opinion, but there's no social capital behind it. It has no pull whatsoever. And no one pays attention to it. They may put a like, or they may do this or they do that. But there's no real, it'd be like, I have some social capital, I believe, in the trapping industry. So if I came out tomorrow and I said, guys, I've been looking things over, and I think the best coyote trap for me and for you is a 1.5 stock Duke. Think about what I just said. Even if you're a 1.5 Duke user for coyotes, just me saying that, because of all the stuff I've done online, and I've been very vocal because I believe in bigger traps for coyotes and all this, that, and the other. Even if you're a big trap guy yourself, if someone that says that, that's got some social capital built up, you're going to go, why in the world did he say that? What made him change his mind? What did he see? What has he learned? I mean, what is going on? And then you would start asking questions, sending PMs on Facebook, want to know if I'm on drugs, you know, if I lost my mind, am I getting sponsored by Duke, whatever, because it would, that opinion all of a sudden would have a different thing. Now, if Billy Bob, the first year trapper, gets a Facebook page and says, I think a number 1.5 Duke is the ultimate coyote trap, he may get some agreements and some negatives. No one's going to pay attention to that one way whatsoever. And then Billy Bob, the first year trapper, which I hope there's no one out there that's got a name like that, because if there is, I don't know who you are and I'm not talking about you. But if Billy Bob, the first year trapper, is so into this, my opinion is the same as everybody else, he's going to get very frustrated and get very ugly very quick, because no one has given him the same response to his, whatever his message is, that he thinks that he deserves. Because if he were to go over to, say, Tim Caven, for an example, and Tim Caven all of a sudden was saying that they're going to discontinue so-and-so trap because they just don't think it's good and yada, yada, yada. And all of a sudden there's all this buzz built around that and all these questions and this, that, and the other. Well, Billy Bob, the first year trapper, is going to be jumping up on top of his little mountaintop going, I'm still here. My opinion matters as much as Tim Caven. I said it, he said it, it's all the same. Well, it's not the same. Tim Caven has social capital in trapping. Everybody knows that. Everybody knows Tim Caven is a super guy. He loves to trap. He builds good comments. He's not one to run his mouth a lot about frivolous stuff. So if Tim Caven actually comes out and says something like that, everybody, regardless if you disagree or agree with what he's saying, is going to step back and think about that just a little bit more than Billy Bob, the first-year trapper on the top of the mountain going, look at me, look at me, look at me. So you've got to, if you have a message, guys, and the reason I'm going to say this, because I see it all the time, and it normally turns negative when someone goes, well, I have the same opinion or a different opinion of them, and my opinion is just as important or not as important. Well, it is and it isn't. The social capital is the reason certain people have their opinions hold more weight than someone that just says something. And then when someone doesn't get the attention that they want because they just said something but they haven't done anything to get social capital, that's when the little hating monster comes out and he goes around and starts attacking everything. And then it's like a race to the bottom on Facebook on what trapper can be the meanest this week, because the haters seem to group up and the non-haters seem to group up and this, that, and the other. But it's all based on social capital. If a hater had social capital, people would pay attention to him. So even though Facebook and the internet and forums give a platform, guys, that you can say whatever you want to say at any time that you want to say it, you've got to realize that every time someone sees what you write on Facebook or a trapping forum or a blog or a video on YouTube, they may or may not be putting very much really thought-provoking, what's the right way of saying it? They may not really care that you're saying it. But if you stick with something and your message is kind of the same and it goes on for a long time and you do other things that start building social capital, especially for you guys out there that are trying to figure out a way to get in different trapping businesses, you're going to have to build that social capital to do that. And one way you do not build social capital is be a hater. Because if you're a hater, that's your social capital, guys, is a whining, sniveling hater. That's all it is. You whine, you snivel. You may be clever in the way that you whine and snivel. You may be funny the way that you whine and snivel about stuff. But you're still just a whiner and a sniveler. So if you're, and I see this a lot, and it's disturbing to see how people try to be a hater to get to success. But what you're doing, guys, is you're building a brand and social capital in being a hater. And that's all everybody's going to ever look at you for, is being a hater or being someone that doesn't matter. And if you want to get, and that, the cool thing, though, the opposite about all this is, if you're Billy Bob, the first-year trapper, and you bust your butt in trapping, and you try to help other people with little stuff that you've learned and supportive of other people, and you go about it that way, after a couple of years, you will have social capital on platforms like that. So when you say something, the attention that you wanted at the beginning that no one will give you, all of a sudden you start getting that attention because of the social capital that you built up. And it's not just going to be about what you catch or figuring out how somebody else is lying or not telling the truth. Social capital only comes from positive. That's it. So if you're wanting to use platforms like that in a business or just as a personal thing to be associated with trappers and stuff like that, that are positive and useful and good at what they do and want to share ideas, which is what the internet was built around, you're going to have to build up that social capital to where someone really pays attention to what you say. And if you're just starting, guys, it's just the way that it is. It's not a bad thing, because if the you've got to earn the respect for someone to listen to what you say. You can't just want it or think that you deserve it. That other person's got to see value in is what you're doing over long term before they start giving that to you. And if guys would understand on Facebook that the social capital of their building's either negative or positive, and if they want to, if their goal is just to be a butthead, well, then a lot of guys are doing a really good job at it. But that's all it's going to be, is a butthead. But if you're wanting to take things different farther, especially in a business like that, you can't be a butthead, because that's just what you're going to get known as. And it's your job to figure out different ways to build that social capital. That's as much as going to conventions, giving demos, talking to kids, like I said, being supportive of other trappers. If you disagree with somebody's technique, you've got to figure out a way, have enough humanity about yourself, instead of writing a response that's just, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard, you're a moron, or something like that. Go, why do you think you need to use 1.5 dukes for coyotes? I mean, what specifically brought you to this conclusion? And then you can start a conversation. And just by doing something as simple as that, you're going to start building the social capital that you want, where people will pay attention to what you say. And anybody that's on Facebook that says they don't care what people say, you're lying to yourself. If you really believe that way, you wouldn't be on Facebook. It's the same thing with forums. If you're always just negative, that's all you're going to be. If you want to be something positive that people actually pay attention to what you're saying, you've got to be positive. And it's not always easy. It's easy to be a butthead. It's simple. It's not easy to try to give people a chance on whatever it is they're saying. Because what you'll find out if you open your mind enough to start thinking that way, there will be people with less experience than you, and I found this a lot, that have saw something or learned something or figured something out that you have not. And if you're too close-minded and you automatically go into, I'm going to show him that he's a moron type mode, you may never learn what it was that person was trying to say, and you're a less of a trapper for it. A lot of the stagnation that people have is just the mindset of that right there. If Craig O'Gorman came out tomorrow and said he thought 1.5 traps were the best traps for coyotes, he's going to have to prove that to me. But I'm not going to call him up and just say he's a moron for saying that, or he's a hypocrite because in 1987 he said this. I'd be like, why in the world are you saying that? That goes against everything you've ever said. What has changed? What have you seen? This, that, and the other. And somewhere in there, I may not totally agree with what he comes up with, but there may be something in there to make me a better trapper. And to me, that is what Facebook should be about. That's the way it should be about. And you're going to have to pick your friends through association on Facebook. If someone is just always a butthead, is that really, because who you're associated with matters. Even online. And if there's a clique of guys that just like to hate on everybody, and you're part of that clique, well, that's what your social capital is always going to be. And I'm just seeing this over and over again. I'm seeing guys that are frustrated because no one pays attention to them, but they haven't gained any social capital to back it up. And then when someone is always a peckerhead on there and they try to be helpful, no one believes them because their social capital says they're a peckerhead and they don't care about anybody but themselves. And then they get even more radical after that point. Or you get guys that get really upset because people pay more attention to other people than they do them. Well, if that is what you want, then you're going to have to earn it. There's nothing wrong with earning anything. It's just the world that we live in, guys. And I know that's a weird thing to talk about on a trapping radio show. I get it. I may have lost some of you on this. I don't know. But what you say today impacts you 20 years from now. And there's some things I probably wish I wouldn't have said 20 years ago. The things I believe in, I don't have any trouble saying whatsoever. But there's also things I could have said in different ways than the way that I've said them, I have no doubt. And part of the reason that I think that it's allowed my business to be successful is building the social capital up by writing the magazines and going to the shows and meeting people and trying to be helpful and this, that, and the other. See, that's not a hard business model to follow, guys, if that's what you want to do. There's a lot of guys that have more social capital than I do in trapping that don't sell anything. But it's totally 100% up to you. If you earn it, you get it. If you don't, well, you're not. And no matter how much screaming, hollering, raising hell you do, no one's going to pay any attention to you. Do you have the social capital to back you up? So I'm going to close on that. And just think about when you're on Facebook and forums and stuff like that, what is it that you're building? A good social capital? Are you losing social capital? Because every time you write something down on that computer, it's never going away. When feelings are hurt, they're going to stay hurt. So it's totally up to you to decide, because you know part of the responsibility of the ultimate freedom of the internet is you got to pay for the repercussions of what you do with that freedom. And it's the only place in life that you don't have people protecting you everywhere that you go like you do in every other form of your life. So just something to think about as you go throughout the week. Think about looking for those plants that you can put on those conibear triggers. And if you're going to be snaring, get creative on how not to have issues with deer, because there's different ways. If you're looking for a really cool business opportunity, guys, that idea about having little bumper pieces of metal, you know, a foot out from your snare that'll close the snare, that'd be a really cool thing to have on the market. Well, till next week, guys. Y'all have fun doing whatever you're doing outside, but try to spend some time outside.